6.2 blank 6.3 39 days after he threw Fleming's money out the window, Ferguson typed the last pages of the final version of his book. He'd assumed he would start to feel all sorts of good things about himself at that moment. But after a brief surge of elation as he rolled the last 5 sheets of paper in carbon out of his typewriter, those feelings soon went away. Even the supposedly eternal good feeling of having proved to himself that he was capable of writing a book, that he was a person who finished what he started and not one of those weak-willed pretenders who dreamed big dreams but never managed to deliver the goods, which was a human quality that pertained to far more than just the writing of books. But after an hour or so, Ferguson wasn't feeling much of anything but a kind of weary sadness. And by the time he went downstairs for a pre-dinner drink with Vivian and Lisa at 6:30, his insides had gone numb. Empty. That was the word for it, he said to himself, as he sat down on the sofa and took his first sip of wine, the same empty space Vivian had talked about when describing how she had felt after finishing her own book. Not empty in the sense of standing alone in a room without furniture, but empty in the sense of feeling hollowed out. Yes, that was it, hollowed out, in the way a woman was hollowed out after giving birth. But in this case to a stillborn child, an infant who would never change or grow or learn how to walk. For books lived inside you only as long as you were writing them. But once they came out of you, they were all used up and dead. How long does the feeling go on? He asked Vivian, wondering if it was just a temporary crisis or the beginning of a plunge into full-blown melancholia. But before Vivian could answer him, Livewire Lisa jumped in and said, "Not long, Archie, only about 100 years. Right, Viv?" "There's one quick solution," Vivian said, smiling at the thought of those 100 years. "Start writing another book." "Another book," Ferguson said. "I'm feeling so burned out right now, I'm not sure I'll ever be able to read another book." Nevertheless, Vivian and Lisa toasted Ferguson on having given birth to his baby, which might not have been alive for him, they said, but it was very much alive for them. And so much so, added Lisa, who hadn't read a single page of the book, that she would be willing to quit her law job if Ferguson promised to hire her as the nanny. Such was Lisa's sense of humor, her nonsensical sense of humor, but it tended to be funny because she herself was funny, and Ferguson laughed. Then he imagined Lisa strolling around Paris with a dead baby in a pram, and he laughed again. The next morning, Ferguson and Vivian walked to the post office on the Boulevard Raspail, their local branch of the state-run PTT, Poste, Télégraphe et Téléphone, which in France was known as the PTT, the triple initials that tripped off the tongue so euphoniously that Ferguson never tired of repeating them. And once they had entered that sturdy edifice of communication services provided to the citizens of the French Republic and all others either traveling through or living in France, they airmailed a copy of Ferguson's manuscript to London. The envelope was not addressed to Aubrey Hull of IO Books, but rather to a woman named Norma Stiles, who worked as a senior editor at Vivian's British publishing house, Thames and Hudson, and happened to be a friend of her younger T&H colleague, Geoffrey Burnham, who in turn happened to be a close friend of Hull's. This was the way Vivian had chosen to submit the manuscript, through the intervention of her friend, who had assured her she would get to the manuscript at once and then pass it on to Burnham, who would then pass it on to Hull. "Wasn't that unnecessarily complicated?" Ferguson had asked Vivian when she proposed the idea to him. "Wouldn't it be faster and simpler just to ship it off straight to Hull himself?" "Faster, yes," Vivian had said, "and simpler, too. But the odds of it being accepted would be close to nil, since over-the-transom submissions generally wind up in the slush pile," both new terms to the uninitiated Ferguson, "and are almost always rejected without a proper reading. No, Archie, in this case, the long way around is the better way, the only way." In other words, Ferguson had said, two people have to like the book before it gets to the only person whose opinion matters. "I'm afraid so. Fortunately, those two people aren't dumb," We can count on them. The mystery is Hull, but at least there's a 98% chance he'll read it. So there they were, on the morning of March 10, 1966, standing in line at the local PTT in the 7th arrondissement of Paris, and when their turn came, Ferguson marveled at how quickly and efficiently the little man behind the counter weighed the package on his gray metal scale, and how eagerly he slapped the postage onto the large brown envelope, and then proceeded to pummel those red and green rectangles with his rubber stamp, canceling the multiple faces of Marianne to within an inch of her life. And suddenly, Ferguson was thinking about the wild scene in Monkey Business when Harpo goes crazy, stamping everything in sight, even the bald heads of the customs officials. And all at once he was flooded with a love for all things French, even the stupidest, most ridiculous things. And for the first time in several weeks, he told himself how good it was to be living in Paris, and how so much of what was good about it came from knowing Vivian and having her as his friend. The cost of the airmail stamps was excessive, more than 90 francs when the insurance and the certified proof of delivery receipt were added in, close to $20, or one-fourth of his weekly allowance. But when Vivian reached into her bag to find the money to pay the clerk, Ferguson grabbed hold of her wrist and told her to stop. "Not this time," he said. "It's my dead baby in there, and I'm the one who pays." "But Archie, it's so expensive." "I pay, Viv, at the Pay-tay-tay. I'm the one who pays." "Okay, Mr. Ferguson, as you wish. But now that your book is about to fly off to London, promise me you'll stop thinking about it. At least until there's a reason to start thinking about it again, all right?" "I'll do my best, but I'm not making any promises." The second phase of his life in Paris had begun. With no book to work on anymore and no need to continue going to the language classes at the Alliance Française, Ferguson was no longer bound by the rigid daytime schedule of the past 5 months. Except for his studies with Vivian, he was free to do whatever he wanted now, which above all meant that he had the time to go to movies on weekday afternoons, to write longer and more frequent letters to the people who counted most for him, his mother and Gil, Amy and Jim, to look for an indoor or outdoor court somewhere so he could start playing basketball again, and to make inquiries about rounding up some potential students for private English lessons. The basketball question wasn't resolved until the beginning of May, and he never managed to find any students. But he did send off a steady flow of letters and saw a staggering number of films. For good as New York had been as a place for watching movies, Paris was even better. And in the next 2 months, he added 130 entries to his loose-leaf binder. So many new pages that the original binder from New York now had a French brother. That was the only writing he did throughout the first part of the spring. Letters, aerograms, and postcards to America, and a growing stack of 1- and 2-page synopses and shorthand observations of films. While working on the final revisions of his book, he'd also been thinking about the essays and articles he wanted to write afterward. But now he realized those thoughts had been fueled by the adrenaline driving him to finish the book. And once the book was finished, the adrenaline was gone, and his brain was kaput. He needed a little pause before he started up again. And consequently, all through the early weeks of spring, he was content to jot down ideas in the pocket-sized notebook he carried around with him on his walks, to sketch out possible arguments and counter-arguments on various subjects while sitting at the desk in his room, and to come up with more examples for the piece he wanted to write about children in films, the representation of childhood in films, from the stinging switchwax delivered to Freddie Bartholomew's rump by Basil Rathbone in David Copperfield, to Peggy Ann Garner walking into the barbershop to retrieve her dead father's shaving mug in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, from the hard slap to Jean-Pierre Léo's head in The 400 Blows, to Apu and his sister sitting first in a field of reeds to watch the train rush by and then perched in the hollow of a tree as rain pours down on them in Pater Panchali, the single most beautiful and devastating image of children Ferguson had ever encountered on film. An image so stark and dense with meaning that he had to restrain himself from crying every time he thought about it. But that essay and the other essays were all on hold for the time being, because he was still so spent from working on his miserable little book that he scarcely had the energy to sustain a sequence of thoughts for more than 20 or 30 seconds without forgetting the first thought by the time he came to the third. In spite of his joke about not being sure if he would be able to read another book, Ferguson read many books that spring, more books than he had read at any time in his life. And as his studies with Vivian moved forward, he felt more and more engaged in what they were doing together, more fully in it because Vivian herself seemed more confident, more comfortable in her role as teacher. So one by one they marched through six more plays by Shakespeare, along with plays by Racine, Molière, Calderon de la Barca, then tackled the essays of Montaigne, as Vivian introduced him to the word parataxis, and they discussed the power and speed of the prose, and explored the mind of the man who had discovered, or revealed, or invented what Vivian called the modern mind. And then it was on to 3 solid weeks with the Knight of the Sad Countenance, who did for Ferguson at age 19 what Laurel and Hardy had done for him as a boy, that is, conquer his heart with an all-embracing love for an imaginary being, the early 17th century fumbler, visionary madman who, like the movie clowns Ferguson had written about in his book, never gave up. Quote, "And for a long while, stumbling here, falling there, flung down in one place and rising up in another, I have been carrying out a great part of my design." The books on Gill's list, but also books about film, histories and anthologies in both English and French, essays and polemics by André Bazin, Lotte Eisner, and the New Wave directors before they started making their own films, the early articles of Godard, Truffaut, and Chabrol, a rereading of Eisenstein's 2 books, the musings of Parker Tyler, Manny Farber, and James Agee, studies and meditations by old venerables such as Siegfried Krakauer, Rudolf Arnheim, and Bela Balazs, every issue of Cahiers du Cinéma from cover to cover, sitting in the British Council Library reading Sight and Sound, waiting for his subscription copies of Film Culture and Film Comment to arrive from New York, and then, after reading in the morning from 8:30 to 12, the afternoon excursions to the Cinémathèque just across the river, only 1 franc for a ticket with his old student card from the Riverside Academy, which the ticket taker never even glanced at to see if the card was still valid. The first and biggest and best film archive anywhere in the world, founded by the fat, obsessive, Quixote-like Henri Langlois, the film man of all film men, and how curious it was to watch rare British films with Swedish subtitles or silent films with no musical accompaniment. But that was the Langlois law, no music. And although it took Ferguson some time to adjust to an all-silent screen and a theater with no sounds in it but the coughs and sneezes of the crowd and an occasional crackling from the projector, he'd come to appreciate the power of that silence, for it often happened that he heard things while watching those films, the slamming of a car door or a glass of water being put down on a table or a bomb exploding on a battlefield. The silence of the silent films seemed to produce a frenzy of auditory hallucinations, which said something about human perception, he supposed, and how people experience things when they were emotionally involved in the experience. And when he wasn't going to the Cinémathèque, he was off to La Pagode, Le Champollion, and one of the theaters on the Rue Monsieur le Prince, or on or behind the Boulevard Saint-Michel, near the Rue des Écoles. And then, most helpful to furthering his education, there was the surprise discovery of Action Lafayette, Action République, and Action Christine, the triumvirate of action houses that showed nothing but old Hollywood films, the black-and-white studio fare of a bygone America that few Americans remembered anymore, the comedies, crime stories, depression dramas, boxing pictures, and war movies from the 30s, 40s, and early 50s that had been cranked out by the thousands. And so rich were the possibilities offered to him that Ferguson's knowledge of American films greatly increased after he moved to Paris, just as his love of French films had been born at the Thalia Theatre and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Meanwhile, Fleming was after him. Fleming was desperate to apologize. Fleming was bending over backward to make up for the night of the money and the tears. And for many days after that night, he called Vivian's apartment at least once a day to talk to Ferguson. but when Celestine slipped the messages under the door of Ferguson's room, Ferguson would tear them up and not call back. 2 straight weeks of unanswered calls, and then the calls stopped and the letters and notes began. "Please, Archie, let me prove to you that I'm not the person you think I am. Please, Archie, allow me to be your friend. Please, Archie, I've met so many interesting students here in Paris, and I would love to introduce them to you so you can begin making friends with people your own age." 3 straight weeks of 2 or 3 letters a week, all of them unanswered, all of them torn up and thrown away. And then, finally, the letters stopped as well. Ferguson prayed that was the end of it, but there was always the possibility he would run into Fleming at another dinner somewhere or accidentally bump into him on the street, and therefore the story wouldn't be officially over until Fleming went back to America in August, which was still months away. The nights continued to be gruesome, with no bed partner or kissing mate of either sex to pull him out of his isolation. But better to be alone with no one to touch than to be touched by a man like Fleming, he said to himself, even if it wasn't Fleming's fault for being who he was. And then Ferguson would switch off the light, lower his head onto the pillow, and lie in the dark, remembering. The industrious and efficient Pétété, which did the same work in France that was divided among 3 entities in America, the U.S. Post Office, Western Union, and Ma Bell, saw to it that the mail was delivered twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon. And because Ferguson's address was the same as Vivian's address, his letters and packages made their initial landing in the downstairs apartment. Once they arrived, the good Celestine would carry them upstairs, slipping the letters under the door of Ferguson's room, or knocking on the door to hand him the things that were too large to fit through that narrow space, his American film magazines, for example, or the books Gil and Amy occasionally sent him. At 9:10 on the morning of April 11th, as Ferguson sat in his room reading Calderón de la Barca's Life is a Dream, La Vida es Sueño, he heard the familiar light tread of Celestine's feet on the stairs, then the creaking floorboards in the corridor as she approached his room, and a moment later a slim white envelope was lying on the floor just inches from his feet. British postage. A business envelope with a printed return address in the upper left-hand corner that read, I.O. Books. Fully expecting bad news, Ferguson bent down, picked up the letter, and then delayed opening it for 6 or 7 minutes, long enough to begin asking himself why he was so scared of something he had already told himself didn't matter. It took another 30 or 40 seconds for him to understand that the bad news he had been expecting was in fact good news, that for an advance of £400 against royalties, it was Io's, quote, enthusiastic intention to publish How Laurel and Hardy Saved My Life sometime in March or April of the following year. But not even the affirmative response from Aubrey Hull could convince him that anyone would truly want to accept his book. So Ferguson concocted a story to explain the letter by silently accusing Vivian of having put up the money to pay for the publication herself, no doubt buying off Hull in one of those sinister backroom deals that had included writing another check for many thousands of pounds to pay for more IO books in the future. Not once since he had moved to Paris had he ever been angry at Vivian. Not once had he ever spoken a harsh word to her or suspected her of being anything less than honest and kind. But this was taking kindness too far, he said to himself. This was turning kindness into a form of humiliation. And on top of that, it was deeply and revoltingly dishonest. By 9:30, he was downstairs in Vivian's apartment, thrusting Hull's letter at her and demanding that she own up to what she had done. Vivian had never seen Ferguson in such a foul temper. The young man was beside himself, fuming with outrageous, paranoiac visions of devious plots and sinister deceptions. And as Vivian later told him, only 2 possible reactions occurred to her as she stood there watching him fall apart. Either slap him across the face or laugh. She chose to laugh. Laughter was the slower of the 2 solutions, but within 10 minutes she had managed to persuade the proud, overly sensitive, pathologically self-doubting Ferguson that she had played no role in the acceptance of his book and had not sent Hull a farthing, a sou, or a single red dime. "Believe in yourself, Archie," she said. "Show some swagger, and for God's sakes, don't ever accuse me of anything like that again." Ferguson promised he wouldn't. He felt so ashamed of himself, he said, so mortified by his inexcusable tantrum. And the worst part of it was that he had no idea what had gotten into him. Crazy, that's what it was, pure craziness. And if it ever happened again, she should forget about laughing and slap him across the face. Vivian accepted his apology. They made up. The storm had passed. And a short time later, they even went into the kitchen together to celebrate the good news by having a second breakfast of mimosas and little crackers topped with caviar. But good as Ferguson was beginning to feel about the good news in Hull's letter, his mad outburst continued to trouble him, and he wondered if that scene with Vivian wasn't an early warning sign of an eventual crack-up. For the first time in his life, he was beginning to feel a little afraid of himself. On the 15th, a second letter arrived from Hull announcing that he would be coming to Paris on Tuesday, the 19th. The IO man apologized for being, quote, so terribly last minute about the trip, but if Ferguson happened to be unengaged that afternoon, he would welcome the chance to meet him. He suggested a 12:30 lunch at Fouquet's, where they could discuss plans for the book, and if the conversation needed to be extended beyond lunch, his hotel was right around the corner off the Champs-Élysées, and they could pop over there and continue. One way or the other, Ferguson could accept or decline by leaving word with the concierge at the George Sank. All good wishes, etc. Based on what Vivian had learned from her friend Norma Stiles, whose knowledge was based on what she had learned from her co-worker Jeffrey Burnham, what Ferguson knew about Aubrey Hull was limited to these facts. 30 years old, married to a woman named Fiona, and the father of two small children, ages 4 and 1. A graduate of Oxford's Balliol College, where he had met Burnham, the son of a wealthy chocolate and biscuit manufacturer, a quasi-black sheep, a gray sheep, who liked to travel in artistic circles and had a good nose for literature, a serious publisher, but also known as a party person and a bit of an eccentric. The vagueness of that portrait led Ferguson to imagine Hull as one of those pompous British gentlemen who showed up frequently in American films, the snide and snooty fellow with a ruddy face and a penchant for mocking under-the-breath remarks that were supposed to be amusing but never were. Perhaps Ferguson had been watching too many films, or perhaps his instinctive fear of the unknown had taught him to expect the worst in all new situations. But the truth was that not only did Aubrey Hull not have a ruddy face or a snide disposition, he turned out to be one of the most affectionate and lovable human beings Ferguson had ever run across in his travels through life. So small, so much a miniaturized sort of man, just 5'3", and every one of his features miniaturized in proportion as well. Small head, small face, small hands, small mouth, small arms and legs. Bright blue eyes. The creamy white complexion of a person who lived in a sunless, rain-soaked country. And a crown of curly hair that fell somewhere between red and blonde on the spectrum. The shade of hair Ferguson had once heard someone call ginger. At a loss for words when they shook hands and sat down for lunch at Fouquet's on the afternoon of the 19th, Ferguson forced himself to try to make conversation by witlessly telling Hull that he was the first person he had ever met with the name Aubrey. Hull smiled and asked Ferguson if he knew what the name meant. No, Ferguson said, he had no idea. The ruler of the elves, Hull said. And so comical and unexpected was that answer to Ferguson that he had to struggle to push back the laugh that was gathering in his lungs, a laugh that could have been misconstrued as an insult, he realized. And why would he risk insulting the man who had accepted his book within the first 2 minutes of their first meeting? But still, how apt it was, how perfectly fitting, that this little man should be the ruler of the elves. It was as if the gods had walked into Aubrey's house the night before he was born and had instructed his parents on the name they should give their child, and now that Ferguson's head was filling up with images of elves and gods, he looked at his publisher's small, handsome face and wondered if he wasn't sitting in the presence of a mythical being. Until that day, Ferguson had known nothing about how publishing houses operated or what they did to promote their books. Other than designing and printing them, he had assumed the principal job was to get them reviewed in as many newspapers and magazines as possible. If the reviews were good, the book was a hit. If the reviews were bad, the book was a flop. Now Aubrey was telling him that the reviews were only one element in the process, and as the ruler of the elves elaborated on what some of the other elements were, Ferguson grew more and more interested, more and more amazed by what would be happening to him when his book was published. A trip to London, for one thing, interviews with the daily and weekly press, interviews with reporters from the BBC, perhaps even an appearance on live telly. An evening event at a small theater where Ferguson would read passages from his book to the audience and then sit down for a conversation about the book with a sympathetic journalist or fellow writer. And, still to be worked out, but what a pleasant prospect if it did work out, a Laurel and Hardy night at the NFT or some other cinema with Ferguson on stage to introduce the films. Ferguson in the limelight. Ferguson with his picture in the paper. Ferguson with his voice on the radio. Ferguson on stage reading to a hushed crowd of devoted fans. How could anyone not want that? The point is, Aubrey was saying, your book is so damned good that it deserves the whole bloody treatment. No one is supposed to write books at 19. It just isn't heard of. And my bet is that people are going to be fucking bowled over by it. Just as I was, just as Fiona was, just as everyone on my staff was. Let's hope so, Ferguson said, trying to keep a lid on his excitement so as not to get carried away by Aubrey's words and end up making a fool of himself. But how good he was beginning to feel now. Doors were opening. One by one, Aubrey was opening doors for him, and one by one there would be new rooms for him to enter. And the thought of what he would find in those rooms filled him with happiness, more happiness than he had felt in months. I don't want to exaggerate, Aubrey said, probably meaning that he did, but even if you dropped dead tomorrow, how Laurel and Hardy saved my life would live on forever. What a strange sentence, Ferguson replied. It could be the strangest sentence I've ever heard. Yes, it was rather odd, wasn't it? First I'm dropping dead, then I'm saving my life, and then I'm living on forever, even though I'm supposed to be dead. Very odd indeed, but delivered from the heart and meant as a sincere compliment. They looked at each other and laughed. Something was beginning to rise to the surface, something strong enough to make Ferguson suspect that Aubrey was coming onto him, that his jolly, ginger-headed lunch companion was the same kind of two-way person he was and had been down this road many times before. He wondered if Aubrey's dick was as small as the rest of him, and then, starting to think about his own dick, he asked himself if he would ever have a chance to find out. You see, Archie, Aubrey continued, I've come to the conclusion that you're a person apart from most other people, a special person. I sensed that when I read your manuscript, but now that I've met you face to face, I'm convinced of it. You're your own man, and because of that, you're a thrilling person to be with. But also because of that, you're never going to fit in anywhere, which is a good thing, I believe, since you'll be able to go on being your own man. And a man who is his own man is better than most men, even if he doesn't fit in. Actually, Ferguson said, putting forth his best and biggest smile, as he plunged into the seduction game Aubrey seemed to have started, I try to fit it in wherever I can, with whomever I can. Aubrey grinned back at him after that obscene retort, heartened to know that Ferguson understood every nuance of the situation. That's what I mean, he said. You're open to all experiences. Yes, Ferguson replied, very open, to one and all. One and all in this case meant the one who was sitting across from him in the posh and pleasingly clamorous Fouquet's, the thoroughly engaging Aubrey Hull, a man who had dropped out of nowhere and was going to do everything in his power to transform Ferguson's life by turning his book into a success. The charming and flirtatious Aubrey Hull, a most desirable and intoxicating sort of man, whose pretty little mouth Ferguson so urgently wanted to kiss, And then, after Aubrey had thrown back another glass or two of wine, the supposed eccentric started calling Ferguson a bonny boy and a lovely lad, a good lad, a fine lad, which wasn't eccentric so much as endearing and arousing. And by the time they finished their lunch, it was all out in the open, with no more mysteries to ponder or questions to be asked. Ferguson sat down on the bed in the fifth-floor room of the Hotel Georges V and watched Aubrey take off his suit jacket and tie. It had been so long since he had been with anyone he cared about, so long since anyone had touched him or had wanted to touch him without first talking about money, that when the ruler of the elves walked over to the bed, climbed into his lap, and put his arms around Ferguson's fully clothed torso, Ferguson shivered. Then he was kissing the pretty little mouth and shuddering up and down the entire length of his body. And as their tongues met and the embrace tightened, Ferguson remembered the words he had said to himself years earlier while riding on the bus to Boston to see his beloved Jim, the gates of heaven. Yes, that was how it felt to him now. And after the rooms he had visited in his mind during lunch, the rooms he had walked into as Aubrey had stood there opening one door after another for him, now another door was opening, and he and Aubrey were walking into the room together. Earthbound men. A bed in a Paris hotel, named after an English king. An Englishman and an American on that bed in their bare, earthbound flesh. Au-delà, the French word for the hereafter. The next world breathing inside them in the here and now of this one. The dick was as small as he had imagined it would be, but as with all the rest of Aubrey, it was fit to the proportions of his miniaturized frame and was no less pretty than his pretty little mouth or any other part of him. The important thing was that Aubrey knew what to do with what he had. At 30, he was far more experienced in bed and body matters than the boys Ferguson had slept with in the past. And because he was a companionable lover with no odd or unsavory inclinations, and no guilt about his passion for fucking and being fucked by boys, he was at once more subtle and more aggressive than Andy Cohen and Brian Mashevsky had been, at once more confident in himself and more generous. A darling person who enjoyed doing it as much as he enjoyed having it done to him. And the hours he spent with Ferguson that afternoon and evening were surely the best and most satisfying hours of Ferguson's life in Paris so far. 1 week earlier, Ferguson had feared he was heading for a crack-up. Now his brain was bulging with 1,000 new thoughts, and his body was at rest. 10 days after traveling to the next world in the arms of his English publisher, Ferguson put his arms around his mother and asked her to forgive him. She and Gil had just landed in Paris. The New York Herald Tribune had shut down and died on April 24th, and with Gil temporarily unemployed until the fall, when he would begin his new career as a professor at the Manus College of Music, Ferguson's mother and stepfather had decided to go on the honeymoon they still hadn't taken after 6.5 years of marriage. 1 week in Paris to start with, then Amsterdam, Florence, Rome, and West Berlin, which Gil had last seen 6 months after the end of the war in late 1945. They were planning to spend their time looking at Dutch and Italian art, and then Gil would show Ferguson's mother the places where he had lived as a boy. Ferguson had finished typing the 3 copies of his book on March 9th. One copy was now sitting on the top shelf of the bookcase in his room in Paris. Another copy was sitting on Aubrey's desk in London, and the third had been sent to his parents' apartment on Riverside Drive in New York. 2 weeks after the manuscript had made its way across the ocean, Ferguson had received a letter from Gil. That was normal, since his mother wasn't much of a letter writer, and 9/10 of the correspondence he sent to the two of them jointly was answered solely by Gil, sometimes with a short P.S. from his mother at the end. "I miss you so much, Archie," or "a 1,000 kisses from your ma," and sometimes not. The early paragraphs of Gil's letter had been full of positive comments about the book and the, quote, outstanding job he had done in balancing, quote, the emotional content of the story with the physical and phenomenological data, and how impressed he was by Ferguson's, quote, rapid growth and improvement as a writer. By the fourth paragraph, however, the tone of the letter had begun to change. "But dear Archie," Gil had written, You must realize how profoundly the book has upset your mother and how difficult it was for her to read it. Of course, reliving such hard days from the past would be difficult for anyone, and I don't fault you for having made her cry. I shed some tears myself. But there were a few spots where you might have been a bit too honest, I'm afraid, and she was stunned by the intimacy of the details you revealed about her. In looking over the manuscript again, I would say that the most offensive passage falls on pages 46 and 47, in the middle of the section about the grim summer the two of you spent at the Jersey shore, locked in that little house together, watching television from early in the morning to late at night, and hardly ever setting foot on the beach. Just to refresh your memory, quote, "My mother had always smoked, but now she smoked without interruption, consuming 4 or 5 packs of Chesterfields per day, rarely bothering to use matches or lighters anymore, because it was simpler and more efficient to light the next cigarette with the burning tip of the last one. As far as I knew, she had seldom drunk alcohol in the past, but now she drank 6 and 7 shot glasses of straight vodka every evening, and by the time she put me to bed at night, her voice would be slurred and her eyelids would be half closed over eyes that could no longer bear to look at the world. My father had been dead for 8 months by then, and every night that summer I would climb under the warm and rumpled top sheet of my bed and pray that my mother would still be alive in the morning. This is rough stuff, Archie. Perhaps you should consider cutting it out of the final version, or at least modifying it to some degree, to spare your mother the pain of having that wretched interval of her life exposed to public view. Stop and think about it for a moment, and you'll understand why I'm asking you to do this." Then came the final paragraph. "The good news is that the Trib is about to croak, and I'll soon be out of a job. Once that happens, your mother and I will be off to Europe, most likely by the end of April. We can talk about it then." But Ferguson hadn't wanted to wait until then. The matter was too disturbing to be put off until the end of April. For now that Gill had lifted those sentences out of the book and isolated them from the surrounding material, Ferguson understood that he had been too harsh and deserved the scolding his stepfather had given him. It wasn't that the passage was untrue, at least from the perspective of his 8-year-old self, as remembered by his older self while he had been writing the book. His mother had been smoking too much that summer. She had been drinking straight shots of vodka and not taking care of the house, and he had been alarmed by the listlessness and passivity that had taken hold of her, at times even frightened by her numbed withdrawal from him as he sat beside her building sandcastles on the beach and she looked out at the waves. The sentences Gill had transcribed in his letter depicted Ferguson's mother at her lowest ebb, at the very bottom of her descent into grief and confusion. But the whole point had been to contrast that lost summer with what had happened to her after they returned to New York, which had marked her return to photography and the beginning of a new life, the invention of Rose Adler. It seemed that Ferguson had made too much of the contrast, however, infusing his little boy fears and misapprehensions of adult behavior into a situation that had been less dire than he had imagined. There had been some vodka, according to what his mother had told Gill, but only 2 bottles over the 46 days they spent in Belmar, and therefore Ferguson had sat down after finishing the letter and had written contrite 1-page responses to both his mother and his stepfather, apologizing for any upset he might have caused them and promising to delete the offending passage from the book. So there he was now on the morning of April 29th, standing in the lobby at the Hotel Pont Royal, with his arms around his jet-lagged mother, asking her to forgive him. Outside, rain was pounding down on the streets, and as Ferguson settled his chin onto his mother's shoulder, he looked through the front window of the hotel and saw an umbrella go flying out of a woman's hand. "No, Archie," his mother said, "I don't need to forgive you for anything. You need to forgive me." Gill was already standing in line at the front desk, waiting his turn to hand over their passports, sign the register, and check them into the hotel. And while he went about that tedious business, Ferguson led his mother to a bench in a corner of the lobby. She looked worn out from the trip, and if she wanted to go on talking to him, as he supposed she did, it would be easier for her to do it sitting down. Worn out, Ferguson added to himself, but no more than anyone else would have been after traveling for 12 or 13 straight hours, and looking just fine, he thought, with scarcely an iota of difference between now and the last time he had seen her 6.5 months ago. His beautiful mother. His beautiful, somewhat exhausted mother. And how good it felt to be looking at her face again. "I've really missed you, Archie," she said. "I know you're a big person now, and you have every right to live wherever you want, but this is the longest we've ever been apart, and it's taken some getting used to." "I know," Ferguson said. "It's been the same for me." "But you're happy here, aren't you?" "Yes, most of the time. At least I think I am. Life isn't perfect, you know, not even in Paris." "That's a good one, not even in Paris. Not even in New York either, for that matter. Tell me, Ma, why did you say what you said a couple of moments ago, before we came over here and sat down?" "Because it's true, that's why, because it was wrong of me to make such a fuss." "I don't agree. What I wrote was cruel and unfair." "Not necessarily. Not from where you were sitting as an 8-year-old boy. I'd managed to hold it together while you were going to school, but then it was vacation time, and I didn't know what to do with myself anymore. A mess, Archie, that's what I was, an unholy mess. And it must have been a bit scary for you to be around me then." "That's not the point." "No, you're wrong. It is the point. You remember Jewish wedding, don't you?" "Of course I do. Mean old cousin Charlotte and her bald, myopic husband, Mr. What's-his-name? Nathan Birnbaum, the dentist. It's been about 10 years, hasn't it? Almost 11 years, and I still haven't talked to them again in all that time. You understand why, don't you?" Ferguson shook his head. "Because they did to me what I almost did to you." "I don't follow." "I took pictures of them that they didn't like. Pretty good pictures, I thought. Not the most flattering pictures in the world, but good pictures, interesting pictures. And when they refused to let me publish them, I let Charlotte and Nathan disappear from my life because I thought they were a pair of fools." "What does that have to do with Laurel and Hardy?" "Don't you get it? You took a picture of me in your book. Lots of pictures, actually, dozens and dozens of them. And most of them were very flattering, some of them so flattering that I was almost embarrassed to read those things about myself. But along with all the flattering pictures, there were one or two that showed me in a different light, an unflattering light. And when I read those parts of the book, I felt hurt and angry. So hurt and angry that I talked to Gil about it, which I shouldn't have done. And then he wrote that letter to you, which made you feel so bad. Bad because I know the last thing you would ever want to do is hurt me. And when you wrote those little letters back to us, I felt I'd done you a wrong turn. Your book is an honest book, Archie. You told the truth in every sentence of it, and I don't want you to revise anything or delete anything for my sake. Are you listening to me, Archie? Don't change a word." The week passed quickly. Vivian suspended their study sessions for the length of the visit. And although Ferguson carried on with several hours of reading in the morning, he met up with his mother and Gil every afternoon for lunch, and then remained with them until it was time to come home and go to bed. Many things had changed in the months since he had left New York, and yet everything was essentially the same. Gil had finished his book on Beethoven after 7 years of work, and he seemed to have no regrets about giving up the pressures of reviewing and journalism for the quieter life of teaching music history at Manus. Ferguson's mother continued to make portraits of well-known people for magazines and was slowly assembling a new book about the anti-war movement at home. She was vehemently pro-anti. She took the small Leica and several rolls of film with her everywhere they went during those days, snapping picture after picture of the protest signs that had gone up all over Paris. U.S. out of Vietnam. Yankee go home, à bas les Amerloques, le Vietnam pour les Vietnamiens, along with numerous shots of Paris street scenes and a couple of rolls of just Ferguson and Gil, both singly and together. The three of them looked at paintings in the Louvre and the Jeu de Paume. They went to the Salle Pleyel for a performance of Haydn's Mass in Time of War. Ferguson and his mother both thought it was extraordinary, but Gil answered their enthusiasm with a pained smile, which meant it hadn't been up to snuff for him. And one night after dinner, Ferguson coaxed them into traveling to the Action Lafayette for a 10 o'clock screening of Mervyn LeRoy's Random Harvest, a film they agreed had enough horseshit in it to fill up 4 stables, But, as Ferguson's mother pointed out, how enjoyable it was to watch Greer Garson and Ronald Coleman pretending to be in love. Needless to say, Ferguson told him about the letter from IO Books. Needless to say, his mother said she would be glad to donate a negative of Archie for the cover. Needless to say, Ferguson took them upstairs and showed them his room on the sixth floor. Needless to say, his mother and Gil reacted differently to what they saw. His mother gasped and said, "Oh, Archie, is it really possible?" Gil, on the other hand, clapped him on the shoulder and said, "Anyone who can make a go of it in here has my full and enduring respect." Other matters were not so simple or pleasant for Ferguson, however. And several times throughout the week, he found himself in the uncomfortable position of having to hold things back from them or having to tell them lies. When his mother asked if he had met any nice girls, for example, he made up a story about a brief flirtation with an attractive Italian student named Giovanna, who had been in his language class at the Alliance Française. It was true that Giovanna had been in the class, but other than 2 30-minute conversations in the café around the corner from the school, nothing had developed between them. Nor had anything developed between him and Béatrice, the highly intelligent French girl who worked as an assistant at the Galerie Mag and was supposedly someone he had dated for a month or two. Yes, Béatrice worked for the gallery, and they had sat next to each other at a Mag vernissage dinner back in December, flirting in a mild, unfocused sort of way. But when Ferguson called to ask her out, she turned him down with the excuse that she was engaged to be married, something she hadn't bothered to mention at the dinner. No, he couldn't talk to his mother about girls, because there hadn't been any girls except for the 5 overweight and underweight hookers he had found in the streets of Les Halles, and he wasn't about to talk to her about them, nor was he going to break her heart by talking about Aubrey and how excited he had been when the ruler of the elves had pushed his stiffened cock deep into his ass. She could never know any of those things about him. There were zones of his life that had to be walled off from her and guarded with utmost vigilance, and because of that, they could never be as close to each other as they had once been, as he still wanted them to be. That wasn't to say he hadn't lied to her in the past, but he was older now, and the circumstances were different. And yet, even as he walked around Paris with her and rejoiced in how happy she looked, rejoiced in how fully she continued to stand behind him, those days were tinged with sadness as well, a feeling that some essential part of him was on the verge of melting away and disappearing from his life forever. There were 3 dinners with Vivian that week, 2 in restaurants and 1 at the apartment on the Rue de l'Université, a small dinner with just the 4 of them and no other guests, not even Lisa, who normally came to all of Vivian's parties. Ferguson was a bit surprised when he was told that Lisa wouldn't be joining them, but then he thought about it for a couple of minutes and understood that Vivian was protecting herself, which was exactly what he would have done if he had been in her place. Like him, she had a dirty secret to hide from the world, and even though Gil was an old friend, he apparently knew nothing about the complicated marriage she had built with Jean-Pierre, and nothing about what she had been up to since Jean-Pierre's death, and therefore could not be exposed to the spectacle of dining with Vivian's new female bed partner. Shades of Aunt Mildred and the cowgirl in Palo Alto 4 years ago, Ferguson said to himself, but with this crucial difference, even at 15, he hadn't cared and hadn't been shocked, but while the 52-year-old Gil might have thought he wouldn't care, he almost certainly would have been shocked. As the 4 of them sat around the dining room table that evening, Ferguson was comforted to see how well Vivian and his mother got along, how rapidly they had turned into friends after just a few encounters. But the 2 women were bound together now because of Gil and their admiration for each other. How many times had Vivian talked about his mother's exceptional photographs? And also because of him, his mother's displaced son now living under Vivian's roof. And again, since coming to Paris, his mother had told him how grateful she was to Vivian for taking care of him and studying with him and giving him so much. And at the dinner that night, she was saying those things directly to Vivian herself, thanking her for watching over her rascal of a boy. And yes, Vivian said, that imp of yours can be quite a handful at times, the 2 of them teasing him because they both knew he could take it and didn't mind. for not only did he not mind, but he actually enjoyed being teased by them. And in the middle of that lighthearted anti-Archie mock-a-thon, it occurred to him that Vivian had a better grasp of who he was now than his mother did. Not only had she worked on the manuscript of his book with him, not only were they plowing their way through the 100 most important works in Western literature together, but she knew everything about his split-into inner self and was, undoubtedly, the most trusted confidant he had ever had. A second mother? No, not that. No need for more mothers at this late date. But what? More than a friend? Less than a mother? His female twin, perhaps. The person he would have become if he had been born a girl. On the last day, he stopped by the Hotel Pont-Royal to see them off. The city was at its best and most beautiful that morning. A bright blue sky overhead, the air warm and clear, good smells floating out of the neighborhood boulangerie, pretty girls in the streets, honking cars, farting mopeds, the whole glorious Gershwinian dazzle of springtime in Paris, the Paris of 100 cornball songs and Technicolor movies. But the fact was that it truly was glorious and inspiring. It truly was the best place on earth. And yet, as Ferguson walked from the apartment house on the Rue de l'Université to the hotel on the Rue Sébastien Botin, even as he took note of the sky and the smells and the girls, he was struggling against the immense weight that had fallen upon him that morning, the dumb and childish dread of having to say goodbye to his mother. He didn't want her to go. A week hadn't been long enough. Even if a part of him knew he would be better off with her gone, that bit by bit he always turned into a baby again when he was with her. But now the ordinary sadness of another farewell had mutated into a premonition that he would never see her again, that something was going to happen to her before they had another chance to be together, and this goodbye would be their last one. A ridiculous thought, he said to himself, the stuff of feeble-minded romantic fantasies, a surge of adolescent angst in its most embarrassing form. But the thought was in him now, and he didn't know how to get rid of it. When he arrived at the hotel, he found his mother in a whirling state of hustle and excitement, wrapped up in the moment, with no time to talk about dark premonitions of fatal diseases and deadly accidents. For on this particular morning, she was going to the Gare du Nord. She was going to Amsterdam. She was on her way out of Paris to another city, another country. Another adventure was about to begin. And there were satchels and suitcases to be loaded into the trunk of the taxi. There were last-minute peeks into her handbag to make sure she had Gil's stomach tablets with her. There were tips to be handed out and doormen and bellhops to thank and say goodbye to. And after giving her son a quick and ebullient farewell hug, she turned to head for the cab. But just as Gil opened the door for her and she was about to climb into the back seat, she turned around and blew Ferguson a big, smiling kiss. "Be a good boy, Archie," she said, and suddenly the bad feeling he had been carrying around with him since early in the morning went away. As he watched the taxi disappear around the corner, Ferguson decided he was going to ignore his mother's wishes and cut the passage from the book. The bad feeling vanished, but as events would prove 10 months later, Ferguson's premonition had not been wrong. The farewell hug he exchanged with his mother on May 6th was the last time they ever touched each other. And once she climbed into the back seat of the taxi and Gil shut the door, Ferguson never saw her again. They spoke to each other on the telephone, one call on the night of his 20th birthday in March 1967. But after Ferguson hung up the receiver, he never heard her voice again. His premonition had not been wrong, but neither had it been exactly on the mark. The deadly accident or disease that Ferguson had imagined would strike down his mother did not happen to her, but to him. In his case, a traffic accident that occurred during his visit to London to celebrate the publication of his book, which meant that after he said goodbye to his mother in Paris on May 6, 1966, he had 304 days to live. Mercifully, he was not aware of the cruel plan the gods had devised for him. Mercifully, he did not know he was destined to have such a brief entry in the book of terrestrial life, and therefore he went on living as if there were thousands of tomorrows in front of him, rather than just 304. 2 days after his mother and Gil left for Amsterdam, Ferguson backed out of going to a party with Vivian and Lisa when he found out that Fleming had been invited. It had been more than 3 months since the night of the money and the tears, and he had long since absolved Fleming of any blame for his part in the misunderstanding. It was the memory of what he had allowed himself to do with Fleming that continued to haunt him, the conviction that it had been his own fault, all his fault. And because Fleming hadn't forced him to do anything he hadn't said he was willing to do, how could he hold Fleming responsible for what had happened? It wasn't Fleming, it was himself, his own shame, the memory of his own greed and degradation, that had prompted him to rip up Fleming's letters and not return his calls. But even if he bore no grudge against Fleming now, why would he ever want to see him again? At breakfast in the kitchen the following morning, Vivian told him about someone she had met at the party, which had been thrown in the courtyard garden of Reed Hall, Columbia University's outpost in Paris. A young man of 25 or 26 who had made a strong impression on her, she said. Someone she thought Ferguson would like just as much as she had. A Canadian from Montreal with a white Quebecois mother and a black American father originally from New Orleans, a person by the name of Albert Dufresne, who had graduated from Howard University in Washington, where he had played on the basketball team, something Vivian supposed would interest Ferguson, which it did, and who had moved to Paris after his father's death, where he was working on his first novel, another thing Vivian supposed would interest Ferguson, which it did, and now that she had captured his attention, he asked her to tell him more. Such as, what is he like? Intense, intelligent, engaged, as in engagé, not a big sense of humor, I'm sorry to report, but very alive, captivating, one of those burning young men who wants to turn the world upside down and reinvent it. Unlike me, for example. You don't want to reinvent the world, Archie. You want to understand the world so you can find a way to live in it. And what makes you think I'd get along with this person? A fellow scribbler, a fellow basketball player, a fellow North American, a fellow only child, and even though his father died only a couple of years ago, a fellow fatherless boy, since his old man absconded when Albert was six and went back to live in New Orleans. What did the father do? Jazz trumpet, and according to his son, a hard-drinking, dyed-in-the-wool, lifelong son of a bitch. And the mother? A fifth-grade schoolteacher, just like my mother. You must have had a lot to talk about. I should also say that Mr. Dufresne cuts a fine figure, a most unusual figure. How so? Tall, about 6'1 or 6'2, lean and muscular, I would guess, although he was standing there with his clothes on, of course, so I can't be more precise. But he seems to be an ex-athlete who's managed to keep himself in shape. Says he still plays hoops whenever he can. That's good, but I fail to see what's unusual about it. It's his face, I think, the striking qualities of his face. Not only was his father black, but there's Choctaw blood in there, too, he told me. And when you mix that up with his white mother's genes, he comes across as a light-skinned black person with somewhat Asiatic features, Eurasian features. A remarkable skin color, I found, with a glowing, coppery cast to it. Skin that's neither dark nor pale. Goldilocks's just right, if you know what I mean. Such lovely skin that I kept wanting to touch his face while I was talking to him. Handsome? No, I wouldn't go that far, but nice-looking. A face you want to look at. And what about his innermost inclinations? I can't say for sure. Usually I can tell right off, but this Albert is something of a puzzle. A man for other men, I'd presume, but a manly sort of man who doesn't want to broadcast his attraction to other men. A macho queer. Perhaps. He mentioned James Baldwin a few times, if that means anything. He loves Baldwin above all American writers. That's why he came to Paris, he said, because he wanted to follow in Jimmy's footsteps. I love Baldwin, too, and I agree that he's the best American writer, but just because he happens to swing toward men doesn't prove anything about the men who like his books. Exactly. In any case, I talked about you quite a bit, and Albert seemed mightily impressed when I told him about your book. Maybe even a little envious. 19, he kept saying. 19, and already about to be published. And there he was in his mid-20s, still grinding away at the first half of his first novel. I hope you told him it was a short book. I did, a very short book, and I also mentioned that you've been dying to play basketball. Believe it or not, he lives on the Rue des Cartes in the 5th, and right across the street from his building there's an outdoor court. The fence is always locked, he says, but it's easy to climb over it, and no one has ever given him any trouble about going in and playing there. I've walked past that court a dozen times, but the French are so strict about locks and keys and regulations, I assumed I'd be deported if I tried to go in. He said he'd like to meet you. Are you interested? Of course I am. Let's have dinner with him tonight. There's that little Moroccan restaurant you like so much, the one just off the Place de la Contrescarpe, La Casbah, and the Rue des Cartes is right up the hill from there. If he doesn't have other plans, maybe he could join us for a platter of couscous royal. Dinner at La Casbah that night with Vivian, Lisa, and the stranger, who showed up 15 minutes late, looking just as Vivian had described him, with that remarkable skin of his and his intense, confident bearing. No, not a person given to small talk or cracking jokes, but he was capable of smiling and even laughing when he felt there was something to laugh about, and whatever hard thing had been locked up inside him was softened by the gentleness of his voice and the curiosity in his eyes. Ferguson was sitting directly across from him. He could see the whole of his face front on, and while Vivian had probably been right to call it a less than handsome face, Ferguson found it beautiful. No, thank you, Albert said when the waiter tried to pour some wine into his glass, and then he looked at Ferguson and explained that he was, quote, off the stuff for now, which seemed to suggest he had been on it earlier, no doubt more than he should have been, an admission of a weakness, perhaps, and coming from such a restrained, self-possessed figure as Albert Dufresne, Ferguson welcomed it as a sign that the man was human after all. Again, the gentle, evenly modulated voice, which reminded Ferguson of how much he had enjoyed listening to his father's voice when he was a boy. And with the bilingual Albert, who spoke with a small trace of a Canadian accent when he spoke French, and a small trace of a French accent when he spoke his idiomatic North American English, Ferguson found himself experiencing a similar, if not wholly identical, sort of pleasure. A meandering conversation that went on for 2 hours, with Lisa more subdued than Ferguson had ever seen her, contributing only a couple of funny interjections instead of 100, as if she were under the spell of the stranger and understood that her antics would have struck the wrong note with him. But how relaxed Albert seemed to be with Vivian, who had that effect on most people, of course, although in this case the effect might have been enhanced because there was something about her that echoed some quality of his mother, a person he was very close to, he said, the white mother of this black man with his despised lout of a dead black father. How complicated it must have been, Ferguson realized, and how much heavy baggage Albert must have been carrying with him. And then they were on to New York and the year and a half he had spent in Harlem after graduating from college, followed by the decision to come to France because America was, quote, a mass grave for every black person who lived there, especially for a black person like him. Meaning a man-man person like him, Ferguson wondered, or was he referring to something else? And then they were all talking about the long history of black American writers and artists who had come to live in Paris. The nude and numinous Josephine Baker, as Albert put it, and Richard Wright, Chester Himes, County Cullen, and Miles Davis in the arms of Juliette Gréco, Nancy Cunard in the arms of Henry Crowder, and Albert's heroic Jimmy, who had been so rudely insulted by not being asked to speak at the March on Washington 3 years ago, he said. But with Bayard Rustin already on the list of speakers, quote, maybe they figured one black fag was enough. The evidence was mounting. And then Ferguson jumped in and started talking about Giovanni's room, which in his, quote, humble, heartfelt opinion, was one of the bravest, most elegantly written books he had ever read, a comment that received an approving nod from Albert. And a moment later, as so often happens with dinner conversations, they were on to another subject, and the two of them were talking about basketball, the Boston Celtics, and Bill Russell, which led Ferguson to ask Albert the same question he had asked Jim many years before. Why is Russell the best when he's not even good? To which Albert replied, But he is good, Archie. Russell could score 25 points a game if he wanted to. It's just that Auerbach doesn't need him to do that. He wants him to be the conductor of the team. And as we all know, a conductor doesn't play an instrument. He stands up there with his baton and leads the orchestra, and even though it looks simple, if there were no conductor to do that job, the musicians would go off key and hit all the wrong notes. The evening ended with an invitation. If Ferguson wasn't busy tomorrow afternoon, he could come over to Albert's place at around 4:30 for a friendly game of one-on-one on his private court across the street from his building on the Rue Descartes. Ferguson told Albert that he hadn't played in months and was bound to be rusty, but yes, he said, he would love to. Thus Albert Dufresne entered Ferguson's life. Thus the man who would come to be known alternately as Albert and Mr. Bear joined the regiment as Ferguson's comrade-in-arms for the next battle in the never-ending Boer War against the pains of human existence. For unlike the two-way Aubrey Hull, who is contentedly married to his one-way Fiona and an adoring father to his two young offspring, the single one-way Albert, whose innermost inclinations tilted toward the Aubreys of this world rather than the Fionas, was available for full-time combat duty, and because he lived in the same city as Ferguson, full-time meant nearly every day, at least for the time the battle lasted. The unexpected developments of their first afternoon together, beginning with the rough, contentious games of one-on-one, as the out-of-practice ex-commando-in-chief crashed the boards against the nimble ex-point guard Mr. Bear, their bodies banging against each other as they tussled for loose balls and tried to block shots. Three close games with 20,000 or 30,000 each one of them, and the laughable twist that white boy Ferguson could outjump black boy Dufresne. And although Ferguson wound up losing all three games because his outside shot was horrendously off, it was clear that they were more or less evenly matched. And once Ferguson rounded into form again, Albert would have to play his hardest to keep up with him. Climbing over the chain-link fence afterward, both of them exhausted, breathing hard, drenched in salty, sticky sweat, and then walking across the street and going up to Albert's third-floor apartment. The order and cleanliness of the two rooms, the wall of 400 books in the larger one, with the bed and the armoire in it, the desk and the Remington typewriter in the smaller room with the pages of Albert's novel in progress piled up in a neat stack. The light coming through the windows in the tidy sit-down kitchen with its wooden table and four wooden chairs, and more light coming through the window in the white-tiled bathroom. Not the kinds of showers one took in America, but the handheld showers of France, standing or sitting in the tub, and spraying oneself with what Ferguson called telephone nozzles. And because Ferguson was the guest, Albert kindly offered him first crack at washing up. So into the bathroom Ferguson went, kicked off his sneakers, removed his damp and smelly socks, shorts, and t-shirt, turned on the water, and stepped into the deep, squarish tub. And all over dousing, with the telephone nozzle held up in his right hand and water splashing down on his head, and with the noise of the water in his ears and his eyes closed to protect them from the hot liquid darts, he did not hear Albert knock on the door. It did not see him enter the bathroom a moment later. A hand was touching him on the back of his neck. Ferguson dropped his arm, let go of the shower head, and opened his eyes. Albert still had his shorts on, but everything else had come off. "I assume you're okay with this," he said to Ferguson, as the hand traveled down Ferguson's back and settled on his ass. "More than okay," Ferguson said. "If it hadn't happened, I would have walked out of here one sad and disappointed customer." Albert put his other hand around Ferguson's waist and pulled his body toward him. "You're such a marvelous boy, Archie," he said, "and I certainly wouldn't want you to walk out of here disappointed. In fact, it would be much better for both of us if you stayed, don't you think?" The afternoon turned into the evening turned into the night turned into the morning, and the morning turned into another afternoon. As far as Ferguson was concerned, this was it, the once-in-a-lifetime Big Bang love, and for the next 256 days, he lived in another country, a place that was neither France nor America nor anywhere else, a new country that had no name, no borders, and no cities or towns, a country with a population of 2. That wasn't to say that Mr. Bear was an easy person to get along with, or that Ferguson didn't go through some rough patches during those 8+ months of sex, camaraderie, and conflict. For the baggage his new friend carried was indeed a heavy burden on him. And no matter how young or brilliant or sure of himself Albert appeared to be when he stepped out into the world, his soul was old and weary, and old and weary souls could be bitter at times, and angry at times, most especially against the souls of the ones who did not feel that same bitterness and anger. Loving as Albert was on most days, frequently with a tenderness and a warmth that overwhelmed Ferguson and made him think there was no better person in the world than the warm and tender man lying beside him in bed, Albert was also proud and competitive and given to making harsh moral judgments about others, and it didn't help that the young one's book was going to be published while the older one was still working on his. And it didn't help that Ferguson's boyish sense of humor was often at odds with Albert's sour righteousness, the giddy splurges of madcap ideas that would come rushing out of him in moments of post-coital happiness, such as the suggestion that they shave off all the hair on their bodies, buy wigs and women's clothes, and then go out to a restaurant or a party and see if they could pull off the gag by passing as real women. Archie, Ferguson said, imitating Celestine's pronunciation of his name. And wouldn't it be interesting if I could actually be a she for one night? Albert's irritable response. Don't be stupid, he said. You're a man. Be proud of being a man. Forget about this drag queen nonsense. If you want to change who you are, try being a black person for a day or two and see what happens to you then. Or else, after a particularly rewarding session in bed, Ferguson's proposal that they get into the business of posing naked together for gay porno magazines, full-color feature spreads of the two of them kissing and giving each other blowjobs and fucking each other in the ass with close-ups of the cum spurting out of their cocks. Wouldn't that be a blast, Ferguson said, and just think of the money they could make. Where's your dignity? Albert shot back at him, once again failing to realize that Ferguson was joking. And why all this talk about money? You might not get much from your parents, but Vivian takes care of you pretty damned well, it seems to me. So why talk about humiliating yourself for a handful of extra francs? That's just it, Ferguson said, leaving behind his whimsical fantasy to address something real, something that had been preoccupying him for the past couple of months. Vivian takes such good care of me, I'm beginning to feel like a moocher. And I don't like that feeling, at least not anymore, I don't. There's something wrong about taking so much from her. But I'm not allowed to work in this country, as you well know, so what am I supposed to do? You could always hustle your ass in queer bars, Albert said. Then you'd get a real taste of what it feels like to live in the mud. I've already thought about that, Ferguson answered, remembering the night of the money and the tears. I'm not interested. As the younger of the two by 7 years, Ferguson was the junior partner in the affair, the little one following the lead of the big one, which was the role he felt better suited to play. For nothing felt better to him than the feeling of living under Albert's protection, of not having to be the responsible one or the one who was supposed to have figured everything out. And by and large, Albert did protect him, and by and large he did take care of him exceedingly well. Albert was the first person he had ever known who shared his double but unified passion for the mental and the physical being, first of all, sex, the primacy of sex over all other human activities, but basketball and working out and running as well, running in the Jardin des Plantes, push-ups, sit-ups, squats, and jumping jacks on the court or in the apartment, and the ferocious, bruising games of one-on-one, which were challenging and fulfilling in themselves, but also served as an elaborate kind of erotic foreplay, because now that he knew Albert's body so well, it was hard not to think about the naked body hidden under Albert's shorts and t-shirt as he moved around on the court, the splendid and deeply loved particulars of Mr. Bear's physical self, and the mental being, not just the functions and cognitive efforts of the brain, but the study of books, films, and works of art, the need to write, the essential business of trying to understand or reinvent the world, the obligation to think about oneself in relation to others, and to reject the enticement of living just for one's self. And when Ferguson discovered that Albert cared about films as well as books, that is, cared about them as much as he himself now cared about books, they fell into the habit of going to films together on most evenings. All kinds of films, because of Ferguson's eclectic tastes and Albert's willingness to follow him into any theater he chose. But of the many films they saw, none was more important to them than the new film by Bresson, Au hasard Balthazar, which opened in Paris on May 25th, and which they sat through together on four consecutive nights, a film that roared into their hearts and heads with the fury of a divine revelation. Dostoevsky's Idiot, transformed into a tale about a donkey in rural France, the downtrodden and cruelly dealt with Balthazar, emblem of human suffering and saintly forbearance. And Ferguson and Albert couldn't get enough of it, because each one of them saw the story of his own life in Balthazar's story. Each one of them felt he was Balthazar while watching the film play on screen. And so they went back three more times after the first time. And by the end of the last showing, Ferguson had taught himself how to replicate the piercing, discordant sounds that burst from the donkey's mouth at crucial moments in the film, the asthmatic keening of a victim creature struggling for the next breath, a horrible sound, a heartbreaking sound. And from then on, whenever Ferguson wanted to tell Albert that he was down in the dumps or aching over some injustice he had seen in the world, he would dispense with words and do his imitation of Balthazar's atonal in-and-out double screech, the bray from beyond, as Albert called it. And because Albert himself was incapable of letting go to that extent and therefore could not join in, every time Ferguson became the suffering donkey, he felt he was doing it for both of them. Similar tastes in most things, similar responses to books and films and people, Albert adored Vivian. But as far as their writing went, they had fallen into a standoff because neither one of them could find the courage to show his work to the other. Ferguson wanted Albert to read his book, but he was reluctant to force it on him. And since Albert never asked to see it, Ferguson held back and said nothing. Nor did he share any news with him about the copy-edited manuscript Aubrey had sent from London, the decision to use his mother's photograph on the cover, or the selection of 10 Laurel and Hardy stills and 10 other stills from movies released in late 1954 and 1955, among them Marilyn Monroe in There's No Business Like Show Business, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis in Artists and Models, Kim Novak and William Holden in Picnic, Marlon Brando and Gene Simmons in Guys and Dolls, and Gene Tierney and Humphrey Bogart in The Left Hand of God. Nor did he say a word about the first-pass galleys, the second-pass galleys, or the bound galleys after they showed up in early July, late July, and early September. And not once did he mention the letter he received from Aubrey, telling him that Paul Sandler at Random House in New York, Ferguson's ex-Uncle Paul, would be co-publishing an American edition of the book 1 month after it was released in England. When Ferguson asked Albert if he could have a look at the first half of his novel in progress, a bit more than 200 pages apparently, Albert said it was still too rough and that he couldn't show it to anyone until it was finished. Ferguson said he understood, which in fact was true, since he hadn't shown his book to anyone until it was finished either. But at least maybe he could tell him what the title was. Albert shook his head, claiming the book didn't have one yet, or rather that he was toying with three different possibilities and still hadn't decided which one he preferred, an answer that could have been true or could have been a polite evasion. The first time Ferguson had stepped into Albert's study, the manuscript had been sitting on the desk near the Remington typewriter. But after that day, the manuscript had disappeared, no doubt into one of the drawers of the large wooden desk. On several occasions during the months they spent together, Ferguson found himself alone in the apartment while Albert was out on an errand somewhere in the neighborhood, which meant he could have gone into the study and pulled out the manuscript from the drawer it was hiding in. But Ferguson never did that because he didn't want to be the kind of person who did those sorts of things, who betrayed the trust of others and broke promises and acted underhandedly when no one was watching. For taking a look at Albert's manuscript would have been just as bad as stealing it or burning it, an act of such repugnant disloyalty that it would have been unforgivable. Albert kept his book a secret, but in other ways he was surprisingly unwithheld, at times even eager to talk about himself. And in their first weeks together, Ferguson came to know many things about his past. Abandoned by his father at 6, just as he had told Vivian on the night they met at Reed Hall. But then, after 17 years of no contact, remembered in his father's will, remembered to the tune of $60,000, enough money to live on in Paris for 5 years or more, with nothing to worry about except his novel. His closeness to his mother, who had been booted out of her strict Roman Catholic family after marrying a black man, and even after the black man left and the family was willing to forgive and forget, his strong, spirited mother had stayed booted out on purpose because she wasn't willing to forgive or forget. Montreal, a city not devoid of black people and mixed-race people, a city where Albert had thrived as a pup, a top boy in sports, a top boy in school, but by mid-adolescence the growing knowledge that he was different from most boys, whether black or white or mixed, and the fear that his mother would find out, which Albert felt would have devastated her. And so he had left Montreal at 17 for college in America at all-black Howard in mostly black Washington, a fine school but a rotten place to live. And bit by bit, during his first year down there, he had come undone. First booze, then cocaine, then heroin, the big crash into apathetic confusion and enraged certainty, a lethal mixture that sent him limping back to Montreal and into the arms of his mother. But better to be a drug addict son than a faggot son, he reasoned. And then she dragged him off to the Laurentian Mountains for the summer and locked him up in a barn for what she called the Miles Davis cure, 4 straight days of vomiting and shitting and screaming, the shaking and wailing grotesqueries of cold turkey detox, the brutal confrontation with his own pathetic nothingness and the puny god who refused to watch over him. And then his mother led him out of the barn and sat with him quietly for the next 2 months as he learned how to eat again and think again and stop feeling sorry for himself. Back to Howard in the fall, and from that day on not a drop of wine, beer, or booze, not a whiff of grass or a snort of coke, clean for the past 8 years, but still frightened to his bones that he would lapse and die an OD death. And when Albert told Ferguson that story on the third day they were together, Ferguson resolved to stop drinking in Albert's presence. He who took such pleasure in alcohol and enjoyed drinking wine almost as much as he enjoyed having sex would no longer drink with dear Mr. Bear. And no, it wasn't fun. It wasn't fun at all, but it was necessary. 10 days after that third day, Ferguson started writing again. His original plan had been to tiptoe back into it by looking over some of his old high school articles to see if anything could be salvaged from them. But after a close examination of the piece on John Ford's non-westerns, which he had once felt was the best essay he had written, he found it crude and wanting, not worth thinking about anymore. He had come so far since then. And why go back when everything in him was crying out to go forward? He had accumulated enough good examples to begin writing the article about the representation of childhood in films, and the ever-evolving Junkyards and Geniuses had been given the simpler, more direct title of Films and Movies, a distinction that would allow him to explore the often fuzzy line between art and entertainment. But in the middle of his deliberations about which piece to write first, something new had come up, something big enough to encompass both of those ideas, and Ferguson was ready to dig in. Gill had sent a letter from Amsterdam, along with a package of books, pamphlets, and postcards from the Anne Frank House at Prinsengracht 263, which he and Ferguson's mother had visited on their last day in the city. It was a museum now, Gill wrote, and the public could climb the stairs up to the secret annex and stand in the room where young Anne Frank had written her diary. And because he remembered how taken Ferguson had been with that book when he'd read it with his 8th grade English class at the Riverside Academy, quote, swept up in it to such a degree that you confessed to having a gigantic crush on Anne Frank, and once went so far as to say you were madly in love with her, I thought the enclosed material would interest you. I know there's something unseemly about the fetishization of this poor girl, Gill continued. after the best-selling book, and then the play and the movie, Anne Frank has been turned into the kitsch representative of the Holocaust for the non-Jewish population in America and elsewhere. But one can't blame Anne Frank for that. Anne Frank is dead, and the book she wrote is a fine piece of work, the work of a budding writer with genuine talent. And I must say that your mother and I were both deeply moved by our visit to that house. After you told us about the essay you're planning to write about children and films, I couldn't help thinking of you when I looked at the pictures Anne had taped onto a wall in the secret annex, cutouts from newspapers and magazines of Hollywood stars, Ginger Rogers, Greta Garbo, Ray Milland, the Lane sisters, which led me to buy you the book of her writings not connected to the diary, Tales from the House Behind. Take a look at the story Dreams of Movie Stardom, a wish-fulfillment fantasy about a 17-year-old European girl named Anne Franklin, Anne Frank did not live to be 17, who writes to Priscilla Lane in Hollywood and is eventually invited to spend her summer vacation with the Lane family. A long trip by air across the ocean, then across the American continent, and once she lands in California, Priscilla takes her to the Warner Brothers studio, where the girl is photographed and tested, and winds up with a job modeling tennis outfits. What a delirium. And remember too, Archie, the photograph that Anne F. pasted into her diary with the caption, "This is a photograph of me as I wish I looked all the time. Then I might have a chance of getting into Hollywood." The slaughter of millions, the end of civilization, and a little Dutch girl destined to die in a camp is dreaming of Hollywood. You might want to think about this. That became Ferguson's next project, an essay of as yet undetermined length entitled Anne Frank in Hollywood. Not only would he write about children in films, he would write about the effect of films on children, especially Hollywood films, and not just American children, but children from around the world. For he remembered having read somewhere about the young Satyajit Ray in India, writing a fan letter to juvenile star Diana Durbin in California. And by using Ray and Anne Frank as his principal examples, he would also be able to explore the art-entertainment divide he'd been thinking about ever since he'd started thinking about films. The lure of entering a parallel world of glamour and freedom. The desire to align oneself with the larger-than-real and better-than-real stories of others. The self levitating out of itself and leaving the earth behind. Not an insignificant subject, and in Anne Frank's case, a matter of life and death. Movies and films. His once beloved Anne, his still beloved Anne, trapped in the secret annex and longing to go to Hollywood, dead at 15, murdered in Bergen-Belsen at age 15, and then Hollywood made a movie about the last years of her life and turned her into a star. "You have no idea how precious these things are to me," Ferguson wrote to his stepfather, thanking him for the letter and the books. "They've crystallized my thoughts and given me a new way into what I want to write about next. Serious. Because of you, the thrust of the thing has been lifted up to a new level of seriousness, and I can only hope I have it in me to do it justice. Tennis outfits, barbed wire villages, watched over by machine guns. Greta Garbo laughing for the first time. Romping on the beaches of California as a typhoid epidemic breaks out in the capital of mud. Time for cocktails, everyone. Time for the lime pits, my starved little dying children. How can we love one another anymore? How can we go on thinking our selfish thoughts anymore? You were there, Gil. You saw it firsthand and breathed in the smells, and yet you've given your life to music. Impossible to tell you how much I admire you and love you." Being with Albert meant not being with Albert for the bulk of the daylight hours. Albert on the Rue Descartes, adding words to his novel. Ferguson in his Chambre de Bonne, reading the books on Gil's list and working on his essay. And then at around 5 o'clock, Ferguson would put down his pen and walk over to Albert's place, where they sometimes played basketball and sometimes didn't. And depending on whether they did or didn't, afterward they would walk down to the noisy market on the Rue Mouffetard and shop for dinner, or else not shop for dinner and go to a restaurant later. And because Ferguson couldn't afford to eat in restaurants, Albert would pay for his share of the check. He was consistently generous with money, and again would tell Ferguson to eat up and forget about it. And then, after going or not going to a movie, usually going, they would return to the third-floor apartment across from the basketball court and crawl into bed together, except on the evenings when Albert came to dinner at Vivian's apartment and would spend the night in Ferguson's little room on the sixth floor. Ferguson imagined it would go on forever, and if not forever, a long time, many more months and years of time. But after 256 days of living in that enthralling routine, the thing he had been dreading about his mother on the morning he'd said goodbye to her in May weirdly and unexpectedly happened to Albert's mother. A telegram at 7 a.m. on January 21st, while the two of them were still asleep in Albert's bed on the Rue Descartes, the concierge knocking loudly on the door and saying, "Monsieur Dufresne, un télégramme urgent pour vous." And all of a sudden, they were both climbing out of bed and jumping into their clothes, and then Albert was reading the telegram, the blue telegram with the black news, that his mother had tripped and fallen down a flight of stairs in her Montreal apartment house and was dead at the age of 60. Albert said nothing. He handed the telegram to Ferguson and continued to say nothing. And by the time Ferguson had finished reading the telegram, which ended with the words, "Come home at once," Albert had begun to howl. He left for Canada at 1 p.m. that same day, and because there were many complicated family matters and financial matters to attend to while he was there, and because he decided to go down to New Orleans after he buried his mother to find out more about his father's life, as he put it in a letter to Ferguson, he wound up staying on the other side of the world for 2 months. And because Ferguson had only 43 days left to live on the day of Albert's departure from Paris, they never saw each other again. Ferguson was calm. He knew that Albert would be coming back at some point, and meanwhile he would forge on and take advantage of Albert's absence to resume his old habit of drinking wine at dinner, glass after glass of drunk-making wine if necessary. For even though he was calm, he was also worried about Albert, who had been hammered by the telegram and had seemed half-deranged when they'd hugged goodbye at the airport. And what if he couldn't hold it together and stumbled into using again? "Stay calm," he said to himself, "and have another glass of wine. Stay calm and keep pushing forward." The Anne Frank essay was more than 100 pages long by now, and had grown into a book, another book, that would take at least another year to finish. But then it wasn't January anymore, it was February. And with the publication of Laurel and Hardy just 1 month away, he was beginning to find it hard to concentrate. Aubrey had not returned to Paris since his brief visit in April, but he and Ferguson had written to each other a couple of dozen times over the past 10 months. So many large and small details to go over concerning the book, but also jocular and affectionate allusions to the hours they had spent together in the fifth-floor room of the Hotel Georges Sank. And even though Ferguson had written that he was more or less shacked up with someone in Paris, the ruler of the elves remained undaunted and was fully prepared for a repeat performance, or several performances, during his author's upcoming visit to London. That seemed to be how things worked in the no-woman world Ferguson was traveling in now. As Albert had once explained it to him, the fidelity rules in force for men and women did not apply to men and men, and if there was any advantage to being an outlaw queer over a law-abiding married citizen, it was the liberty to bonk at will with whomever you wished, whenever you wished, as long as you didn't hurt the feelings of your number one. But what did that mean exactly? Not telling your number one that you had been with someone else, Ferguson supposed. And if Albert was bonking someone or several someones on his peregrinations through North America, Ferguson wouldn't want to know about it, nor would he say anything to Albert if he wound up bonking Aubrey in London. No, not if, he said to himself, but when. When and where and how many times during the days and nights he would be in England. For even though he loved Albert, he found Aubrey irresistible. The plan was to release the book on March 6th, a Monday. Ferguson would celebrate his 20th birthday in Paris on the 3rd, then take the boat train from the Gare du Nord on the night of the 4th and arrive at Victoria Station on the morning of the 5th. In his most recent dispatches, Aubrey had confirmed that interviews and events had been lined up as promised, including the Laurel and Hardy evening at the National Film Theater, a program of shorts that would bring together the 20-minute Big Business, the 21-minute Two Tars, the 26-minute Blotto, and the 30-minute Howler of the Century, The Music Box. And once the NFT's decision was passed on to him, Ferguson spent a full week composing one-page introductions to each of the four films, panicked by the thought of freezing up in front of the audience if he tried to wing it on stage without notes. And because he wanted his little text to be charming and witty as well as informative, it took many hours of writing and rewriting before he was even remotely satisfied with the results. But what fun that night was going to be, and what a thoughtful and generous thing Aubrey had done for him. And then, just 24 hours after he finished the introductions, two advanced copies of the book arrived in the afternoon mail on Wednesday, February 15th, and for the first time in Ferguson's experience of the world, the past, the future, and the present were one. He had written the book, and then he had waited for the book, and now the book was in his hands. He gave one of the copies to Vivian, and when she asked him to sign it for her, Ferguson laughed and said, "I've never done this before, you know. Where am I supposed to sign it, and what am I supposed to say?" "The title page is the traditional spot," Vivian said, "and you can say whatever you like. If you can't think of anything, just sign your name." "No, that won't do. I have to say something. Give me a minute, all right?" They were in the living room. Vivian was sitting on the sofa with the book in her lap, but instead of sitting down beside her, Ferguson began pacing back and forth in front of her, and after a couple of backs and forths, he left the area around the sofa and walked to the farthest wall in the room, turned right and walked to the next wall, then turned right again and walked to the next wall after that, and then he turned around and walked back to the sofa where he finally sat down next to Vivian. "Okay," he said, "I'm ready. Give me the book and I'll sign it for you." Vivian said, "I think you're the strangest, funniest person I've ever known, Archie." "Yeah, that's me, a genuine laugh riot. Mr. Ha-Ha in a purple clown suit. Now give me the book." Vivian handed him the book. Ferguson found the title page and reached into his pocket for a pen. But just as he was about to begin writing, he paused, turned to Vivian and said, "It's going to be short. I hope you don't mind." "No, Archie, I don't mind. Not in the least." Ferguson wrote, "For Vivian, beloved friend and savior, Archie." The Earth spun around 16 more times, and on the evening of March 3rd, they celebrated his 20th birthday with a small dinner at the apartment. Vivian had offered to invite as many others as he wished, but Ferguson had said, "No others, thank you." He wanted to keep it in the family, which meant the two of them, along with Lisa and the absent Albert, who was wandering around the South trying to track down members of his father's family, and even though Ferguson knew it was ridiculous, he asked Vivian if they could set a place for Albert, in the same spirit as the place that was set for Elijah at Passover. And Vivian, who didn't think it was ridiculous, asked Celestine to set the table for four. A moment later, she decided to increase the number to six, so that Ferguson's mother and stepfather could be included as well. He had 2 days to live, and it was the last time he would ever talk to them. But the phone call had been arranged in advance, and 1 hour before he sat down to dinner with Vivian and Lisa on the night of the 3rd, his mother and Gil rang from New York to wish him a happy birthday and good luck on his trip to London. Ferguson told Gil that he would be carrying along Our Mutual Friend with him, the 91st book on the list, which would keep him company on the two long trips across the Channel, 11 hours each. But he doubted he would have much time for it in London because his schedule had become so crowded there. In any case, there would be only 9 books left after this one, and he and Vivian were planning to get through all of them by the end of May. But what a pleasure it was to be living inside that Englishman's teeming brain, he remarked. And after he and Professor Vivian had polished off number 100, he wanted to catch up on all the Dickens novels he still hadn't read. Then his mother came on and started talking to him about the weather. England was a wet place, she said, and he should remember to carry an umbrella with him at all times, and wear his raincoat, and perhaps even buy a pair of rubbers to protect his shoes and feet. On any other day, Ferguson would have felt annoyed. She was talking to him as if he were a 7-year-old child, and normally he would have brushed her off with a groan or laughed her off with some droll and acerbic comment. But on this particular day, he didn't feel annoyed, but amused, both warmed and amused by the unending motherness that continued to burn inside her. "Of course not, Ma," he said. "I won't go anywhere without my umbrella, I promise." As it happened, Ferguson left his umbrella on the train after he arrived in London on the morning of the 5th. He hadn't meant to lose it, but in the scramble to gather up his belongings and rush out onto the platform to look for Aubrey, the umbrella had been forgotten. And yes, rain was falling on the city that morning, just as his mother had predicted it would, for England was indeed a wet place, and the first thing that struck Ferguson about it were the smells, the assault of new smells that entered his body the instant he left the air of his compartment for the air of the station. Smells that were altogether unlike the smells in Paris and New York. A harsher, more stinging atmosphere, charged with the mingled emanations of damp woolen jackets and burning coal and moistened stone walls and the smoke of players' cigarettes with their too-sweet Virginia tobacco, in contrast to the bluntness of Gauloise and the toasty fragrances of Lucky's and Camel's. A different world. Everything utterly different, and because it was still early March and not yet spring, a new sort of chill in the bones. And then Aubrey was smiling at him and throwing his little arms around Ferguson's body, declaring that the bonny boy had alighted at last, and what a good week it was going to be for both of them. Off to the cab stand outside, where they huddled together under the dome of Aubrey's black umbrella and waited their turn, talking first about how happy they were to see each other again. But a few moments later, Aubrey, the publisher, was telling Ferguson, the author, that the first reviews of the book had started coming in over the past days, and that they had all been good except for one, an excellent piece in the New Statesman, a rave in the Observer, but nothing less than good with any of the others except for the pissy nonsense in Punch. "How nice," Ferguson said, understanding how much those opinions meant to Aubrey, but he himself felt curiously detached from it all. As if the reviews had been written about someone else's book, another person with the same name as his perhaps, but not the person who was stepping into a London taxi for the first time, one of the fabled black elephant cars he had seen in so many films over the years, and which turned out to be even bigger than he had imagined, another British thing that was different from American and French things, and how enjoyable it was to be sitting in the huge area and back, listening to Aubrey rattle off the names of magazine editors and reviewers he knew nothing about, and who were no more real to him than walk-on characters in an 18th-century play. Then the cab took off and started heading toward the hotel, and suddenly it was no longer enjoyable, but disconcerting and even a bit scary. The steering wheel was on the wrong side of the car, and the driver was driving on the wrong side of the road. Ferguson knew perfectly well that the English did it that way, but he had never experienced it himself, and by force of long habit and a lifetime of built-in reflex reactions, his first ride through the London streets had him flinching every time the driver made a turn or another car approached them from the opposite direction, and again he had to close his eyes for fear they would crash. A safe landing at Durrant's Hotel at 26 George Street, W1, not far from the Wallace Collection and St. James's Roman Catholic Church. Durrant's, as in Currants, and Aubrey said he had chosen it for Ferguson because it was so quintessentially British and respectable. Not mod London, but an example of what he called plod London, with a wood-paneled bar on the ground floor that was so stodgy and spectacularly arcane that C. Aubrey Smith was a regular there, even though he had been dead for 20 years. "And besides," the ruler of the elves continued, "the beds are ever so comfortable." "You and your dirty mind," Ferguson said. "No wonder we get along so well. Birds of a feather, my young Yankee friend, with dandy doodles in our pants and a fine pair of ponies to take us to town." Aubrey helped Ferguson check in, but then he had to rush off and go home. It was Sunday, the nanny's day off, and he had promised to stay with Fiona and the children until tea time, at which point he would return to the hotel for a pony ride and then take Ferguson out to dinner. "Fiona can't wait to meet you," he said, "but it won't happen until tomorrow, alas." As for me, I can't wait until you come back this afternoon. When is tea time, by the way? For our purposes, anywhere between 4 and 6. You can rest up until then. Those channel crossings can be brutal on the system, and you must be feeling fried, or at least sautéed. Believe it or not, I managed to sleep on the train, so I'm good. Uncooked, as it were, raw and fresh and raring to go. After Ferguson unpacked, he returned to the ground floor and went into the dining room for breakfast, which was still being served at 10 o'clock, and had his first taste of English cuisine, a platter that consisted of 1 sunny-side-up egg, greasy but delicious, 2 undercooked rashers of bacon, slightly repellent but delicious, 2 pork sausages, a thoroughly cooked tomato, and 2 thick slices of homemade white bread, slathered with Devonshire butter that was better than any butter he had ever tasted. The coffee was undrinkable, so he switched to a pot of tea, no doubt the strongest tea anywhere in Christendom, which he had to dilute with hot water before he could get it down his throat. And then he thanked the waiter, stood up from his chair, and trotted off to the gents for a long, unhappy session with his rumbling bowels. He wanted to go out for a walk, but the mild rain that had been falling earlier had turned into a downpour, and rather than go upstairs and lock himself in his room, he decided to visit the famous wood-paneled bar and look for the ghost of C. Aubrey Smith. The bar was empty at that hour, but no one seemed to mind when he asked if he could sit in there for a while as he waited for the weather to clear. Sun was forecast for the afternoon. And because the porter was so friendly about it when he asked the question, Ferguson decided that he liked the English and found them to be a noble, generous people. Not stiff in the way the French could be, not angry in the way Americans could be, but good-natured and calm, a tolerant folk who accepted the foibles of their fellow men and didn't butt in or condemn you for speaking with the wrong accent. So Ferguson sat down in the vacant wood-paneled bar and mused about the English for a while, in particular about C. Aubrey Smith and the nice but unimportant fact that he, the most English of all English gentlemen, the very embodiment of England for American audiences in countless Hollywood films, had been another ruler of the elves, in this case, the elves of movie land. And before long, Ferguson had pulled out the little notebook he carried around in his jacket pocket and was writing down the names of British actors who had worked in California and, to a degree Ferguson had never considered until that morning, had helped create what the world now thought of as American movies. So many names and so many films with those names on the list of credits. And as Ferguson wrote them down off the top of his head, or rather plucked them out from within his head as each one occurred to him, he included the titles of the movies he had seen those names act in and was astonished by how many there were. An avalanche of films and more films and more films. Too many films, finally. An appalling number of films. No doubt there were many others he had forgotten as well. To begin with the first name on his list, the inevitable Stan, partner of Ollie, born Arthur Stanley Jefferson in the town of Ulverston in 1890, and then taken to America in 1910 with the Fred Carnot Company as Charlie Chaplin's understudy. More than 80 films seen with Stan Laurel in them, more than 50 with Chaplin, and at least 20 with C. Aubrey Smith, including Queen Christina, The Scarlet Empress, The Lives of a Bengal Lancer, China Seas, Little Lord Fauntleroy, The Prisoner of Zenda, and hundreds more with Ronald Colman, Basil Rathbone, Freddie Bartholomew, Greer Garson, Cary Grant, James Mason, Boris Karloff, Ray Milland, David Niven, Laurence Olivier, Ralph Richardson, Vivian Leigh, Deborah Carr, Edmund Gwenn, George Sanders, Lawrence Harvey, Michael Redgrave, Vanessa Redgrave, Lynn Redgrave, Robert Donat, Leo G. Carroll, Roland Young, Nigel Bruce, Gladys Cooper, Claude Rains, Donald Crisp, Robert Morley, Edna May Oliver, Albert Finney, Julie Christie, Alan Bates, Robert Shaw, Tom Courtney, Peter Sellers, Herbert Marshall, Roddy McDowell, Elsa Lanchester, Charles Lawton, Wilfred Hyde White, Alan Mowbray, Eric Bloor, Henry Stevenson, Peter Ustinov, Henry Travers, Finley Curry, Henry Danielle, Wendy Hiller, Angela Lansbury, Lionel Atwill, Peter Finch, Richard Burton, Terence Stamp, Rex Harrison, Julie Andrews, George Arliss, Leslie Howard, Trevor Howard, Cedric Hardwick, J. John Gielgud, John Mills, Haley Mills, Alec Guinness, Reginald Owen, Stuart Granger, Gene Simmons, Michael Caine, Sean Connery, and Elizabeth Taylor. The rain stopped at 2, but the sun didn't come out. Instead, the cloudy sky filled with more clouds. Clouds so thick and voluminous that they started to sag, slowly descending from their customary place in the heavens until they touched the ground. And when Ferguson finally stepped out of the hotel for a short walk around the neighborhood, the streets were a labyrinth of fog. Never had he been given so little to see in what was supposedly still the daytime. And he puzzled over how the English could go about their business in these sodden, vaporous murks. But then again, he said to himself, the English were probably on intimate terms with clouds. For if he had learned nothing else from Dickens, it was that the clouds in the sky over London came down for frequent visits among the people. And on a day such as this one, it looked as if they had brought along their toothbrushes and were planning to spend the night. It was a few minutes past 3. Ferguson decided he should start walking back to the hotel to prepare himself for Aubrey's return, which could be as early as 4 or as late as 6. But he wanted to be ready at 4 in the hope that Aubrey would be able to detach himself from his family early rather than late. A bath or a shower first, and then he would put on the birthday presents Vivian had bought for him in Paris last week. The new pants and the new shirt and the new jacket that made him look like $1 million, she had said. And he wanted to look like $1 million for Aubrey in his new clothes. And then the clothes would come off and they would climb onto the bed to do what they had done at the Hotel George Sank. And no, he wouldn't feel guilty about it, he said to himself. He would enjoy it. And as far as Albert was concerned, he would console himself by imagining that Mr. Bear was doing the same thing with someone else and enjoying it just as much as he was. And as he walked along thinking about Aubrey and Albert and the differences between them, not only the physical differences between light and dark and large and small, but the mental differences and cultural differences and the differences between their outlooks on life, the somber depths of Albert's heart as opposed to Aubrey's whimsical good cheer, Ferguson marched on in the direction of the hotel, suddenly shifting his thoughts to the interview he would be doing with someone from the Telegraph tomorrow morning at 10, the first interview of his life. And even though Aubrey had told him not to worry and just relax and be himself, he couldn't help feeling a little worried. And what did it mean to be himself anyway, he wondered. He had several selves inside him, even many selves, a strong self and a weak self, a thoughtful self and an impulsive self, a generous self and a selfish self. So many different selves that in the end, he was as large as everyone and as small as no one. And if that was true for him, then it had to be true for everyone else as well, meaning that everyone was everyone and no one at the same time. And with that thought bouncing around in his head, he came to the intersection of Marylebone High Street and Blandford Street, at the spot where Marylebone turned into Thayer, just around the corner from the hotel on George. And even though the fog was pressing in and wrapping itself around him, Ferguson could make out the blinking red traffic light looming in the blur, a blinking red light that was the equivalent of a stop sign. So Ferguson stopped and waited for the car to pass. And because he was lost in his reveries about everyone and no one, he turned his head and looked to the left. That is, did what he had always done when crossing streets throughout his life, the reflexive, automatic look to the left to make sure no car was coming, forgetting that he was in London and that in English towns and cities, one was supposed to look to the right and not to the left. And therefore he did not see the maroon British Ford sweeping around the bend on Blandford. So he stepped off the curb and started to cross the street, not understanding that the car he hadn't seen had the right of way. And when the car slammed into Ferguson's body, it hit him so hard that he went flying into the air, as if he were an airborne human missile launched into space, a young man on his way to the moon and the stars beyond. And then he reached the top of his trajectory and started to come down, and when he touched bottom, his head landed on the edge of the curb, and he cracked his skull. And from that moment on, every future thought, word, and feeling that would have been born inside that skull was erased. The gods looked down from their mountain and shrugged.